Well, hi, everybody, and welcome back. This is Dave. Thank you for your flexibility in tolerating the disruption last week. We're back, and our third seminar we'll talk about this evening. And next week, remember, if you'd like to add on a bit of time for discussion and just a conversation at the end of the seminar, please send me any questions you have that we haven't answered. And here's what I'm currently doing. I have received from a number of you the most important takeaway that you have had from each of the first two seminars. And I welcome you sending for any of the seminars, each of you. I'm compiling those, and I will send them around to you because I think it'll be interesting maybe to review and maybe to see what colleagues have found more useful or beneficial in each of the seminars. So I welcome that. Any questions, brief discussion, or things that would be helpful to talk about before we launch into our topic for today? We're going to be talking about mindset mastery and the importance of that. Can I get a management of the background noise? I'm hearing you rustle paper and move things. If you're not ready to talk, if you do a mute star six, we'll go on lecture mode in just a moment, so you don't have to worry about that. But any questions or comments or takeaways that you'd like to highlight or ask about? I wanted to share with you it's an ultra brief story, which is unusual for me, the ultra brief part. This is a story that I'm using as part of an introduction to a new book I'm working on, but I thought it might apply here especially when we're bringing together so many different aspects to apply and strategic coaching and what you're doing with marketing. And here's the story. And this is a well-known physicist. When Dr. Helen Czerski was studying physics at Cambridge, she was in her grandmother's kitchen looking at textbooks and charts of quantum physics. Her grandmother looked at her material and asked, "What can you do when you know that?" Dr. Czerski spent a professional lifetime answering that question and the unspoken follow-up question that she knew her Nana didn't say as she waited for the answer. And why should I care? That's exactly what I'm hoping to do, to bring together a synthesis of things that will be meaningful to you and applicable in a strategic way for what you actually do and to put into action in your story, your coaching and marketing story. So anything you'd like to discuss just briefly, final call before we move into the material? I'll reserve some time at the end, a brief time for any discussion or questions or clarification. So if anything comes up, jot it down. And again, I welcome through email things you think about through the week as you may review or reflect this. And I know a number of you are listening to the recording and not able to attend live time, especially in different countries with the goofy time zones. So I welcome that, so feel free to offer that. I'm putting us on lecture mode. Okay, we're going to talk about mindset mastery development, and I'll define that, but I want to first give you the quiz. As you know, we begin with a quiz so that you can think about maybe how to frame an aspect of this. Carnegie Mellon University did a large study to determine the major factor of professionals trying to earn the trust of others. Which do you think they found is the most important factor for professionals of different persuasions earning trust of others? Being an established, proven expert? The confidence of the professional? demonstrated current expertise, or stellar reputation? Jot down your answer. We'll come back to that. Mindset is simply a set of assumptions and beliefs that determines how we perceive, process, and behave. It's analogous to the software program of each state of mind. Our mindsets consciously and unconsciously determine our choices. Once we boot up a mindset, it frames what we're going to perceive and how we're going to process. The simplest example I've seen, one of the people whose research I follow, Dr. George Lakoff, the social scientist, in his next-to-last book, the title says everything as an example of this. The title is Don't Think of an Elephant. Elite athletes know to get themselves in an optimum state before going on the court or field, and then how to sustain it. Masterful actors, speakers, storytellers, artists do as well. Executives, getting in state is mental, emotional, and physical. There is an entire science of mind, brain, and performance that is applicable here. A significant persuasion and leadership competency is self-regulation and self-management, knowing your own skills and deploying them effectively in a mindset that's matched to the task. So let's talk about that. And like her unspoken Nana's question, what difference should it make? Okay? So we'll talk about mindset strategies of successful persuasion. How do you get a potential prospect you may not know or don't even see in a state of mind to consider your service or your product? Successful people who are top sellers. Now, the footnote, the sidebar combined here is we're not selling. We're professionals. We're making a recommendation. But I'm using this as a shorthand to think about marketing. Successful people and top sellers regulate the emotional state of the prospect, manage the prospect state, and market effectively and enjoyably while building trust and throughout to create and sustain interest and commitment. Now, this takes understanding the prospect's needs and to demonstrate how what you offer will meet them. So remain flexible. The person most flexible masters the situation. Whatever meaning you associate to a stimulus determines behavior. That boosts up the mindset. To persuade, know and communicate the emotional reasons to buy now. And secondly, the logical reasons that it makes sense to buy now and how you'll be glad you do it. The next time you want someone to get on board with your idea or service, simply tell a story where you spell out the best outcome. We now know from the mind and brain sciences that storytelling is the most powerful way to plant ideas into someone's mind. Think about your experience. When we're being told an effective story, it activates not just the language processing areas, but the areas also that are used in experiencing the events of the story. Someone tells how delicious a peach is, our sensory cortex lights up. When it's about emotion, our right neocortex gets active. When the story characters grab objects, motor neurons activate. When the characters observe a scene, vision-related neurons fire. A story puts our whole brain to work. That's why the mind and brain sciences are so important to incorporate in marketing. Stories affect us mentally as well as physically. Ann Crindell at the Dartmouth Brain Lab showed how viewers' brains resonated with the specific emotion enacted on the screen. When the central character was angry, the viewer's brains registered anger as well. When the scene was sad, the viewer's brains corresponded. Whenever we feel disgust, that brain region, the anterior insula, fires. we sense the other person's intentions and imagine what an experience means to us. Mindsight, our innate ability to see into someone else's minds, relies on attunement of empathic resonance with the other's subjective experience. The teller's state of mind and intention is a key to the listener's reception. The listener is the person you are offering your services or your product to. For example, if we sense the other person may be distracted, we kind of automatically distance or tune out. If someone genuinely smiles and looks directly into our eyes, it enhances the inclination to relax and feel more trusting. This means that getting in state needs to be before you communicate with your reader or listener or viewer. Relax your body, control your breath, get grounded solidly to access an optimum state of mind for a particular task. The primary reason to get in state is to concentrate your energy into a full, undisturbed immersion in your engagement, to be totally grounded and centered, because that's contagious. A state of mind is the most instantly contagious thing in the world. It happens by fiber optic, by telephone, by audio. It happens instantly. It's faster than the fastest virus. People like, respect, trust, and are influenced by those who have the ability to remain calm and thoughtful. This default setting to remain centered and grounded no matter what becomes an essential success paradigm. Like any state of mind, it's contagious. Amygdala to amygdala, midbrain to midbrain, the first receptor that will receive from another person, and it's in the emotional part of the brain. Regulating your own state of mind in a sustained way is the most effective influence on someone else to do the same. So here are some mindset tools of persuasion. These are in your outline, but I wanted to kind of bring them to life and talk about them. The law, or the principle, really, of authenticity, the most valuable gift you have to offer is yourself. So first, build a rapport, connect, an empathic resonance. For a long-term impact, establish authentic, caring, and emotional investment and understanding. Highlight mutual interest. Tell a story that involves a challenge. Ask what you can do for them. Give an authentic compliment. Give a meaningful gift, possibly. Secondly, instead of give information, facts, your beliefs, ask questions. Direct the focus from problems to possibilities. How you frame something determines the whole mindset to engage. Move to a mindset of possibility, of openness, of exploration. A change of focus changes state of mind. Perhaps, if it's applicable, paint a picture of a positive outcome. And I'll tell you a story about this in a moment. When people imagine, it becomes real for them. So the outcome needs to be for them, and I'll illustrate this. Third, personal congruity. What you say verbally and non-verbally need to match. A tool of influence comes from feeling certain about what you're saying. Again, confidence is a state of mind that's instantly transferable. The person who feels the most certain is the greatest influencer. And four, state management. First of yourself, and then to manage the emotion and state of mind of the prospect as you collaboratively proceed. So here's one way of thinking about the difference between success and failure. The couple of most important determinants of success are two things: beliefs and state management. Beliefs are important, but the belief is the blueprint. It's the software of the unconscious mind. Focus aligns the energy field of the brain, and repeated focus rewires the brain. In this way, belief becomes an anatomical reality. Beliefs determine what we will or what we won't do, even what we will or won't see. What we believe, the meaning we feel certain will come from situations, determines how we behave and what we'll do. Social neuroscientists show us that we have to believe in what we're selling, or we won't sell. So, how can you create a new belief? The oak sleeps in the acorn. Success comes to those who become success conscious. You guys are doing it right now to look at some considerations to consider, to see what makes sense to you, what you want to incorporate as a way of thinking and possibly of doing. Failure comes to those who indifferently allow themselves to become failure conscious. The only known method of voluntary conscious development of belief is repetition of affirmations to your unconscious. This is a total sidebar here. This is how someone, when they tell a lie long enough, will come to believe it's true, and their brain will register it as truth because it's rewired their brain. Same with a belief and a positive belief that we want to be of benefit to others. We come to believe what we repeat to ourselves, whether it's true or false. And again, if a lie is repeated, it ultimately is experienced as the truth. The teller ultimately can't tell the difference. The neuroscience principle really emphasizes the need and power of positive focus. Visions are the seedlings of reality. If you can't see significant wealth in your imagination and vision, you won't see it in your bank account. Systematic, repeated visualization rewires the brain. Affirmations are stories that support the visualizations to revise mind software. You are not ready for something until you believe you can acquire it or create it. Belief can be inscribed by affirmation or repeated instructions to your unconscious mind. Repetition of affirmations to your unconscious mind is a powerful method of voluntary development of belief. Any thought that is repeatedly passed on to the unconscious mind becomes finally accepted. This is as true for wealth accumulation as it is for other consistent repetitions, such as crime. So there are a couple of types of beliefs. One, global beliefs. Think about it as, well, life is like this. People are. I am. Each affects the way we look at and interpret things and their meanings. Another kind of belief, in addition to global beliefs, are rules, our own set of heuristics of how we attribute cause and effect. Our beliefs, well, if this, then that. We have brain algorithms of behavior, emotional, attachment patterns that couple cues and responses. This is why we never have to go back into the past to look at the history, the origin, the dynamics, the early aspects of an issue a client's dealing with. If it's important, the conversation here and now, every algorithm that client uses to determine thought, feeling, behavior, what they do, attachment patterns, every algorithm will manifest itself in the relationship with you in the process. So the first cell, or let me back up a minute. People are going to say yes more readily to your belief than to information or technical sales skills. I mean, think about it. If they have Google, you don't need information, data, tell them what you think or believe. They come to believe what you believe. So the first sell is to yourself. Selling is transference of emotion. You must feel certain to make someone believe. The primary way you convince someone else is if you are convinced. You will transfer whatever state of mind you're in, whether that's doubt or confidence. Here's a personal example. I believe that when someone works with me in mentor coaching, they're going to create a way to transform into a way of being, operating, and doing that will change them for the rest of their lives and benefit them significantly, whether in their life or business or both. They can know that without knowing the words, because those are not words that I use with a client, but it's conveyed in the belief, in the confidence that I have in recommending to someone a specific aspect or type of work with mentor coaching. So, second area, state management. Here's an everyday application to recognize and understand your emotional couplings. Regardless of how logical we think we are, our first register of any new stimulus is emotional. Any new input goes directly to the amygdala. Then it sorts that and conveys a kind of significance, then moves it to the hippocampus to attach meaning. Then it goes to the forebrain to process consciously and intellectually. That's the third step. We become consciously aware of something to make logical sense. Here's a footnote. The hippocampus is the primary location of the unconscious, where meanings are attached, coming from the subspecialty of psychoanalysis. This is so much of what's talked about, but at a brain level, the hippocampus attaches meaning. We'll come back to that. Not to the psychoanalysis, you can say, thank God. Our state of mind, the software package, determines the meaning we attach to a stimulus, and the meaning attached determines the behavior. Each state of mind, just like each software program, contains its own beliefs, associations, sets of experience, and operating principles. You're at home, relaxing after dinner with your partner, just had a glass of wine, a great conversation. There's a noise in the backyard. You probably don't notice it. Or if you do, you dismiss it. Next evening, you're home alone, and you have just watched Criminal Minds. You hear the same noise. You're alert to it, maybe vigilant. Go check it out. Same stimulus, but the state of mind determines the meaning attached, and the context gives it additional amplification that you're home alone. Everything at the lower emotional brain and the midbrain are unconscious processes. We're not. And that's part of our operating system, the 90 to 95% that's not conscious, logical, intellectual. This is an operating system that goes on all the time, that we attach meaning and engage in default modes of what we do and say and feel and think. The emotional activation registers before cognitive areas of the brain come into play to assess the options. Neuroeconomics research, for example, demonstrates that we make decisions, especially buy or purchase decisions, up to 10 seconds before we're even consciously aware. And I'll reiterate here, a neuroeconomics lab that I correspond with, they can hook, let's say, 10 people up to an fMRI, show them 10 objects, and ask them to decide which one they'll purchase. They can predict over 95% of the time what item each person will purchase, because what the purchase is determined by is the activation of that specific area of their brain that has to do with their sense of self, their identity. Someone buys what they identify with. So once we unconsciously make an emotional commitment to a yes or no, these lower brain structures send the conscious mind on a mission to gather the logical reason to make it make sense, to support the decision. Then we cherry-pick data to support that pre-selected belief. We find something logical and sensible for it to light on, even if it's not accurate cause and effect. The rationalization becomes a confirmation bias. The failure to notice contradictory data becomes an inattention blindness. When we make a choice, we couple memory, past experiences, with the best guesses of a likely future. Our lives are determined by our choices. These choices are informed by what we focus on and shaped by the meaning that we attribute. And remember, much of it is not conscious, so this is part of self-awareness and self-reflection to be aware of this process and the meanings we attach. The part of the brain that anticipates pleasant outcomes, the nucleus accumbens, activates a buy decision. A don't buy decision originates in the insula, the area involved in anticipating pain. The anticipatory emotional bias as well as drive decision-making from these two basic perceptions, to avoid pain or to seek pleasure. An example here. Credit cards decouple buying. Buying, remember, or the anticipation of it, activates the pleasure center, the dopamine. And pain activates the pain center in the brain. You give up something of yours, your money. The pleasure of the purchase, then, with a credit card, is segmented from the pain of future payment. This segmentation renders repayment actually a future abstraction. Maybe our optimism bias even suggests, well, we're going to have more money later. At the very least, my dear self, tomorrow's another day. People buy 23% more when they pay by credit card than they do when they pay check or cash. So one application, it's hard to save because of the way our minds work and our brains are wired. It's hard to resist the immediate pleasure of buying. That's the dopamine hit. We don't get a dopamine hit when we save for the future. Making and spending money both activate the pleasure center in the brain. It's difficult to substitute a theory of future need, long-term saving, retirement, for the immediate payoff. So here are three reasons people fail. Also, here are these three reasons that someone may tell you in a variety of language and lexicon, no thank you. Not enough compelling reasons, limiting belief systems, and inability to consistently manage state of mind. So let's look then at regulation of states of mind. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to any stimulus. And the meaning you attach then determines your behavior. And there are two primary ways to regulate a state of mind, physiology and focus. Physiology is how you use your body, your biochemistry, to change your state of mind. Some basic tools to regulate physiology. Mindfulness meditation to focus just on your breath. Relaxation. Deep breathing. Anything that narrows the focus and has as part of the experience a relaxation. Note that this is the antithesis of thinking of new stuff, letting your mind go. In mindfulness meditation, when you have a thought, as inevitably you will because that's your brain's job description, you let it go. You let it float away, or you don't engage it in your own way. Refocus on your breathing. So that's the physiology. The focus here is what and how you direct conscious attention. Now, from quantum physics and the brain, you get what you focus on, not what you want. Focus aligns your energy field. What you focus on, what you pay attention to, determines your state of mind. Our minds work by consciously selecting the one focus that we want to register at any moment. By holding this one thing in conscious awareness, we give relative inattention to everything else. This means that we have an immediacy bias. We assign undue weight to whatever we pay attention to at the moment. But think of the positive application here and the analogy of mindfulness meditation, where you get in a relaxed state, focus just on your breathing, breathing in, relaxation, breathing out, tension. That's also the process that you began your coaching session. Your first question likely is, what would you like us to focus on? So you help define and refine by asking questions if the client is not really clear at the beginning what they want to focus on. And then you ask to create a map that you both collaboratively agree to. Where would you like us to get to in this session? That's the map. You know where you are, where you're going. You can measure progress along the way. You can tell what's detour and distraction. So this focus in terms of what we're doing, whatever we're doing, is of primary importance, to be able to focus specifically on what we want to do. The questions we ask determine what we focus on. Questions direct the focus and determine the state we're in. Another simple example, we've talked before about how our brains can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. It activates in exactly the same way. So how we frame it, if we frame it as anxiety, that means better head for cover, better protect ourselves. If we frame it as excitement and opportunity, we look at how can we create a way to pursue what's next. So how you frame it determines the mindset that you boot up to deal with the entire remainder of this conversation. Now, here's an example of how you get what you focus on, not what you want. And this is from neuroscience, from quantum physics. We get what we focus on, not what we want. Most of you have seen or read The Secret. Ask, believe, receive. What you focus on, I think it needs to be ask, believe, create, the ABCs instead of receive, because you know, trust me, I've tried that with lotto tickets, but it doesn't work. And a pizza truck is not going to back up in your driveway because you ask and believe. You have to create. So here's an example. The great aerialist Carl Wallenda, the patriarch of the flying Wallendas, has performed death-defying feats on the high wire for more than 50 years. Still, at this time, at the age of 71, Wallenda's capacity for focus on his intention was legendary. His concentration on success became a self-fulfilling prophecy for over five decades of amazing triumph on the high wire. What you focus on grows. Wallenda's wife indicated that he had been anxious the day before taking the wire, a light, tight rope, at that time in San Juan, Puerto Rico. For the first time in all the years that she'd known him, he focused on the risk of falling. He personally supervised the attachment of the guy wires, which he had never done before. During the performance, he tragically fell to his death. You get what you focus on. Asking effective questions determines a focus and a state of mind for your client. This is your power of focus. And for yourself, ask habitual questions that empower you. And in terms of marketing, look at what questions your client, your prospect, really want answered. What are their challenges? What are they already asking? The best mentors, leaders, and teachers are the ones who ask the best questions to get us to use our own resources. So let's look at optimum performance state of mind. The difference between a professional and an amateur, between massive success or less, is the ability to manage your state of mind, to achieve and sustain a peak performance state. So a mindset formula for optimizing persuasion, since that's what we should be talking about this seminar. Find the challenge, the problem, the deep want or interest that is unfulfilled in the other person. Show the prospect how to solve the problem or meet the challenge. Associate positive consequences when they do. You may determine from them, rather than initiating yourself, the negative consequences if they don't. This mindset formula of persuasion associates buying with getting pleasure and not buying with pain, even though not spelled out in that way. That's a little too heavy-handed for my taste. People will do more to avoid pain than seek pleasure, risk aversion. This is why we focus on results and positive consequences for more effectiveness, because the person will fill in their own reasons, and we're creating an alternate narrative. The primary reason we do what we do is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. I can't emphasize that enough. I want to say it again. The primary reason we do what we do is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. Think about if you've been coached, if your coach asks you, how do you envision feeling or imagine feeling when you've completed this? The persuasion process is centered on getting the prospect to clearly associate the most desired feeling or state with your service or your product. So here are three primary reasons that someone fails to persuade. There's no compelling purpose during a challenging time. Limiting beliefs, such as, it won't work, I've tried this before, I've tried everything and nothing works, are not consistently managing mindset. This ability to manage a state of mind is the difference between success and failure. Of the insights that neuroscience brings to the business world, one of the most powerful is the ability to understand how a consumer connects various concepts about your brand at an unconscious level. It is crucially important to have a clear and exact understanding yourself of the elements that make up the identity of your brand and an awareness of how that's perceived by others. Now, this is the subject of our last seminar next week on neuromarketing. So we're going to go more into that about how this happens at brain level and how you can understand that and create and enhance success. Think of this very simply. People love people who change their state. That's why entertainers are paid so much more than educators, pro athletes more than service people. We want to be around people who change our state for the better. We're willing to pay significant bucks for that. Now, let's apply that to your business. Selling is transferring emotion. Your state of mind will have emotional contagion. Manage your state because it induces a related state in the other person. You associate positive or emotional states or negative emotional states to your service or product. Then the prospect does as well. They'll follow your lead. If you're not in a peak state, such as in a down feeling or lesser expectation, that's going to be conveyed. And someone will not recognize consciously why they're deciding against what you're offering or just simply saying no. Authentic energy is contagious. When your story truly excites you and you let that excitement show, it will be infectious to prospects. Your authenticity of genuine enthusiasm and conviction will resonate with prospects. Now, you got to stay out of the way. You know, you want to speak clearly, briefly, simply. You don't want to start talking in paragraphs because we know from neuroscience that attention and retention lasts up to 10 to 12 words. So state it clearly, briefly, simply, and then engage in a conversation. So here's a question. Why can someone who begins at a peak state with a prospect come across as hyper or like a typical salesperson and turn the prospect off? I'll bet you can remember your last experience or maybe many others like this. Why is that? And it creates a response like an eye roll at an over-the-top or off-the-wall spiel that turns the listener off by the second or third sentence, sometimes second or third word. The answer? They don't begin where the prospect is. Remember, the first thing we do with a prospect is to empathically resonate, become attuned, and find a way to communicate our understanding of that experience. The result is to co-create a common ground. I'll do an exercise with you in just a moment about how to look at that visually. A reciprocal connection and conversation. Then the client or prospect can go someplace new with you to follow your lead. You co-create a state that is a mutual journey, a process to arrive stepwise at the same place. Now, here's the simplest example that I know of, the best supervision I ever had about this principle when I didn't know it was a principle. Many years ago, when I was still practicing psychoanalysis, I had a succinct and powerful lesson. It was a very accomplished woman executive who was in analysis with me. I offered an interpretation to her that I thought would be particularly helpful. She paused. Finally, she rose up on her right elbow on the analytic couch, looked back at me in my chair, and said, "No, Kruger, first you have to be with me before I can go someplace new with you." A simple, brilliant synopsis of this principle. We have to be with a client before the client can go someplace new with us, or with the purchaser, the customer for your services. So consider three questions for your reflection. How much money, how many prospects have you lost because you haven't been in a peak state? Let's say in the last 3 months, the last 3 years. How much has it cost you emotionally? Regret, pain, less energy, less money of not being in a peak state in the last 3 months? In the last 3 years. In the next 10 years, what will it cost you if you don't master this ability? In the next 10 years, what if you operate at peak state and enjoy the process? Again, selling is transference of emotion. You associate your state to your product or service. People associate your state to your product or service. People buy a state of mind. State change is activating. So there are four basic mindset management principles. State is what you're selling more than a product or service. Selling is influencing the prospect's focus, the value, the benefits, the pleasure, and maybe avoiding pain. Questions determine what we focus on and the state we're in. And finally, the mindset of self-reflection fosters thoughtfulness and depth and wisdom. So, peak state. Match the optimum state of mind to the specific task. Anchor yourself for success. Peak performance comes from being in a peak state. The quickest way to change your state is to change the way you're using your body to cue that change. We talked about the simple example of focusing on breathing to get grounded, centered, relaxed. Develop a cue or a gesture that immediately puts you in an optimum state. Here's an additional resource that will extend and apply what we're talking about tonight. On the bottom page of my website, Mentor Path, there's a free webinar at the absolute bottom of the homepage. Click on the link and you'll see a webinar that addresses master states of mind. And there's some illustrations in there. I think I share a case about how I first developed the notion for a couple of the things that I talk about in there. So if you have time and interest, I think it might be helpful to you. So, confidence is a state of mind. People naturally associate confidence with expertise. The induction of a shared experience, a mutual influence of energy fields, is what creates this confidence and receptivity in the client. So remember the Mindset Mastery Quiz, the Carnegie Mellon study. the major factor for professionals earning the trust of others? The confidence of the professional. Simple, confident explanations trump expertise. Mirror neurons and energy fields resonate with someone's emotional state and influences behavior. Confidence is more correlated with success than competence or expertise. This is a summation of a number of very sophisticated studies. Confidence is more correlated with success than with competence and expertise combined. Confidence is what initially engages someone. It's what people will pay you for. Then, with your skill and expertise, you co-create a new story with that client that will help them attain successful performance and results. Since we know that confidence is a significant predictor and determinant of success, be aware of conscious and unconscious biases. An example, in studies with business school graduates, men initiate salary increases 40% more than women do. And when both ask, women ask for 30% less than men. At Manchester Business School in England, Professor Marilyn Davidson said, I've been doing this for 7 years, and every year there are massive differences between the male and female responses. The male students expect to earn significantly more than the women, and when you look at what students think they deserve to earn, the differences are huge. We can never earn more in the outside world than we can earn in our own minds. This is the constancy of setting the thermostat, the default mode, and moving the thermostat back to the set point whenever there's a variation. We have to achieve it in our minds to change the thermostat before we can achieve it in reality. And this is important. Once something that's unconscious becomes conscious, it's no longer unconscious. So you make an active decision about that. So this is, let me ask you a couple of questions in application of this, application of mindset. What's the best time to make a sale? After a vacation and you're relaxed? When you have debt? When you're in a dry spell and really motivated? The best time to make a sale is right after a sale. Confidence is a state of mind. Sustaining an optimum state is as important as changing a negative state. And consider this from the prospect's point of view. What's the major thing that holds the prospect back from making a purchase? Think about that for a minute. How would you respond? Primary thing holding a prospect back. Here are the top four. Fear of making a mistake, concern of not getting value, worry of paying too much, and a question of not being able to really put the product or service to use. Now, let's switch. What's the major thing that holds the salesperson back? The fear of rejection. The prospect may say no. The major thing that keeps you from getting what you want is your story about why you can't get what you want. Think about that. Now, here's an application that I've already mentioned, and I want to just elaborate a little bit about. And this comes from the whole field of study and research of conversational intelligence. Neuroscientists show us that the first few words of a conversation boots up a particular mindset in the listener to process the remainder of that exchange. A conversation that begins with authoritative or critical or adversarial remarks, or ones that are perceived in that way, activates the brain circuitry in the recipient of fight and flight and protection. This reaction is processed by the cortisol, adrenaline, neurochemical system. The listener closes down a bit for self-protection. Now, consider a very different beginning, just the first few words of a conversation. Think about the last conversation with your adolescent that worked and that didn't work. That's your best example. A conversation that begins in a collaborative, collegial mode activates the brain's neurochemical system of bonding and connection and induces listening and collaboration without judgment to engage more fully. This initial collaborative trusting response is mediated by oxytocin, the neurochemical system of bonding and connection, which frames the remainder of the conversation. So be very aware of a mindset and an initial framework of a conversation. Now, the most challenging people that I have dealt with in really getting this in terms of collaboration are pro athletic coaches. They know exactly what every player on that field or that court needs to do. And when they tell them exactly what to do, it usually doesn't work. Because when someone hears something, a belief, a fact, or an idea, they're going to immediately compare it to what they already know or believe. That's an anatomical reality in the recipient's brain. So they're going to compare what they hear. If they agree with it, if it fits, they're going to find ways to confirm it, confirmation bias. If it doesn't fit, they're going to find ways to refute it. So either way, they're not in a collaborative framework. So what's the opposite? Asking a question. There's nothing to oppose. It engages someone in a collaborative way. This is the framework we use in coaching to develop a collaborative discussion based on the client's story and the client's point of reference. So all successful sales are based on one factor, a relationship. People don't buy from people they don't like, and people can't sell to people they don't like. Enthusiasm accounts for more of sales closing than any other factor. The transfer of enthusiasm changes the state of the other person. Confidence begets enthusiasm. So the key to developing an effective engagement is simply twofold. To know and resonate with the prospect's needs, their essential challenge, and to know your unique proposition, what you do better than anyone else, but make it about the client. What is it that is unique and special about your product or service in 10 words or less? People won't buy your product because it's as good as everybody else's. They'll buy it because it's unique in some way for them. It resonates with their identity, their needs and ideals. Your key job is to identify that unique advantage that sets you above everyone else and build your presentation around that. Now, hint at the result. Plant a seed of the benefit in your first question. Focus on the key benefit that the prospect will enjoy, need, or resonate with. Not what you've done, not your experience, not how long you've been doing what you're doing, not your credentials, not how many books or papers you've written. This is about the client. It's not about you. It's only about the client. If you ask a question, people are conditioned to respond to the question before they respond to anything else. Make sure your question can be focused on or lead to the benefit that will engage them and result in a collaboration together in moving forward. Now, I want to close with an example and kind of a brief exercise. I'd like you to take a piece of paper, just a clean piece of paper, and in the middle of the paper, draw a circle. Now, inside that circle, draw a stick figure. Imagine your potential client or your customer is that stick figure. To visualize the challenge and have some sense of what their needs are, that stick figure is someone who needs perhaps to understand the world in the way that you do, and you have to convey that based on their point of reference. People who don't understand the way the stick figure does remains outside the circle. So your primary challenge is to get inside the circle. Otherwise, they won't listen to you. So you get inside that circle by resonating with their experience or their need. The challenge is your prospect does not see you as belonging in that circle. They're not going to listen. Your point of view will not be seriously considered. You remain an outsider with little influence. Outside, they're not going to listen to you. To enter, identify your prospect's biggest challenge. Resonate with that experience. Articulate the challenge or pain points as clearly as you can to move into the circle. Listen carefully. Identify the kinds of emotions your prospects feel. Then put yourself in their shoes to ask yourself, why are they feeling that way? What are their specific challenges? To see what they see, feel what they feel, and then find some part of their emotional experience that you can authentically, genuinely resonate with. You have to resonate with your audience where they are, not where you are, and find a way to communicate that understanding in the purpose of getting into the circle. Now, here's a description of how the circle technique works. It was described, actually, in a different context by the Wall Street Journal, of how Obama began winning presidential primaries, and people were puzzled about how he was charming voters in the heartland. Reporter Stephen Hayes followed Obama around and analyzed his circle strategy. And here's a way he put it. When Obama addresses a contentious issue, he almost always begins his answer with a respectful nod in the direction of the view he's rejecting, a line or two that suggests he understands or perhaps even sympathizes with the concerns of the conservative. Remember our discussion about Lincoln and how he presented the other person's side first. Then Obama moves into the circle. Lincoln's approach to arguing a case. Hayes cited an example in which Obama was asked about the Second Amendment. He began his answer by saying, having taught constitutional law for 10 years, he believes the Second Amendment grants individuals the right to carry guns, the conservative position, and that he respected the right of lawful gun owners to hunt to protect their families. Only then, after he was in the circle, did Obama go on to talk about how he thought there should be new laws to help trace firearms used in crimes. At the end of his answer, Obama employed one final circle move to kick his opponent out of the circle. And he said, the argument I have with the NRA is that they believe any constraint or regulation whatsoever is something that they have to beat back. And they don't think that's how most lawful firearm, and I don't think that's how most lawful firearm owners think. So Obama was left standing next to the lawful firearm owners, his audience, inside that circle, while the NRA has just been declared bereft of common sense, not like us, cast out of the circle. Winning means not only getting inside in this situation, but pushing the opponent out. The circle vision suggests to bring your audience to your side. Your first move is to resonate with and go with where they are. Connect with the audience. Then you can move forward together. So here's a way simpler, and I know where I'm kind of usurping our discussion time, but just two final quick things. Here's the Girl Scout version of entering that circle and what we're talking about. Most Girl Scouts are taught to memorize a fairly complicated spiel, one that involves introducing themselves, some detail about the good work the Scouts do, and finishing with how the money raised goes for great purposes. Now, this is tough work for a professional, much less for a kid talking to an adult stranger. It can be even scary. It's unlikely to lead consistently or massively to a positive experience. But here's an alternative that more than immediately doubles the sales rate. It's the question. Again, you begin with a question. What's your favorite kind of Girl Scout cookie? Questions focus our brains, and the first few words determine the state of mind. In 10 words or less, all the nostalgic memories of Cookie's past are summoned. In one simple question, the power and the transaction shifts, with the Girl Scout going from requesting to supplying, to resonate with the experience of the listener. It's a question that avoids a no or yes. It's a question that starts a conversation, a question that opens the door to emotion. Those are the kind of questions that create value and build careers. The experience from the buyer's point of view is an emotional connection to something that's been in his or her life since being a kid. There's a reason they don't change the flavors very much, as well as a positive reaction to a young person learning to speak up and having a significant purpose. Selling a state of mind far outpaces only selling Thin Mint cookies. Changing a strongly held belief has more to do with storytelling than facts or logic. Storytelling is emotional and persuasive. Stories are more powerful than data because they allow us to identify emotionally with ideas and people otherwise disregarded or seen as outsiders. We tend to align with people who share our identity, even if the facts agree. So what I'm going to request from you, read the Mindset Mastery summary in your outline of the facts and the issues and the points that we've just discussed. Would you send me, in your words, what the most important thing is that you're taking away from this seminar? If you have not done so and want to reflect on the first and the second seminar, please include that. I'm very interested. As I said, I'm going to synthesize and compile these and send them around to everyone. My apologies that I didn't really allow enough time for discussion, questions. We'll do that at the beginning and the end of our seminar next week. So thanks very much, and I appreciate the very positive and engaging responses you've had and the things you've sent, and I request more. I'm interested in how you're putting together this, finding this, and other things that you'd like to talk about. Keep that in mind for our discussion at the top of the hour next time, and we'll add on a bit to have a live discussion. Thanks very, very much. Take good care of yourselves, and I look forward to picking up with you right here next time. See you guys. Bye now.